For some time he sat there, going through his file cards, then looking up bundles of papers, shaking his head negatively as he tossed them back and removing another bundle. "Ah," he said at last, then fell silent. Minutes later, he said, "Yes, I have a job for you." He rifled through his papers, changed his spectacles and reached out blindly towards a pile of cards. Picking up the top one, he placed it in front of him and slowly began to write. "Now where is it? Ah, Clapham, do you know Clapham?" Without waiting for a reply, he continued, "It is a photographic processing works. You will work by night. Street photographers in the West End bring in their stuff at night and collect the proofs in the morning." "Yes, let me see," he went on fumbling through the papers. "You will sometimes have to work in the West End yourself with a camera as a relief man. Now take this card to that address and see him," he said, pointing with his pencil to a name he had written on the card. Clapham was not one of the most salubrious districts of London. The address to which I went, in a mean back street in the slums adjacent to the railway sidings, was an ill-favoured place indeed. I knocked at the door of a house which had the paint peeling off, and one window of which had the glass repaired with sticky paper. The door opened slightly and a slatternly woman peered out, tousled hair falling over her face. "Yea. Oh, what I want?" I told her, and she turned without speaking and yelled, "Erry, man, to see ye." Turning, she pushed the door shut, leaving me outside. Sometime later the door opened, and a rough-looking man stood there, unshaven, no collar, cigarette hanging from his lower lip. His toes showed through great holes in his felt slippers. "What do I want, cock?" he said. I handed him the card from the Employment Bureau. He took it, looked at it from all angles, looked from the card to me and back again, then said, "Foreigner, eh? Plenty of em in Clapham. Not so choosy as us Britishers. Will you tell me about the job?" I asked. "Not now," he said. "I've got to see you first. Come in, I'm in the basement." With that he turned and disappeared. I entered the house in a considerably fuddled state of mind. How could he be in the basement when he had been in front of me, and what was the basement anyhow? The hall of the house was dark. I stood there not knowing where to go, and I jumped as a voice yelled beside me, seemingly at my feet, "Hi cock, ain't you coming down?" A clatter of feet, and the man's head appeared from a dimly lit basement door which I had not noticed. I followed him down some rickety wooden stairs, fearing that any moment I would fall through. "The works," the man said, proudly. A dim amber bulb shone through a haze of cigarette smoke. The atmosphere was stifling. Along one wall was a bench with a drain running through its length. Photographic dishes stood at intervals along it. On a table off to the side stood a battered enlarger, while yet another table, covered in lead sheet, contained a number of large bottles. "Imery," said the man, "make up your solutions so I can see how your shape." As an afterthought, he added, "We always use Johnson's Contrasty, brings em up real good." Harry stood aside, striking a match on the seat of his trousers so that he could light a cigarette. "Quickly I made up the solutions, develop a stop bath, and fixer." "Okay," he said. "Now get a hold of that reel of film and run off a few proofs." I went to make a test strip, but he said, "No, don't waste paper, give em 5 seconds. Harry was satisfied with my performance. "We pays monthly, cock," he said. "Don't do no nudes. Don't want no trouble with the cops. Give all the nudes to me. The boys sometimes gets ideas and slips in special nudes for special customers. Pass em all to me, see? Now you starts here at 10 tonight and leaves at 7 in the morning, okay? Then it's a deal." That night, just before 10, I walked along the dingy street, trying to see the numbers in the all-pervading gloom. I reached the house and climbed the untidy steps to the scarred and blistered door. Knocking, I stepped back and waited, but not for long. The door was flung open with a creak from its rusted hinges. The same woman was there. The one who had answered my knock earlier. The same woman, but what a different woman. Her face was powdered and painted, her hair was carefully waved, and her almost transparent dress, with the hall light behind her, showed her plump form in clear detail. She directed a wide, toothy smile at me and said, "Come in, dearie. I'm Marie. Who sent you?" Without waiting for my reply, she bent over towards me, her low-cut dress sagging dangerously, and continued, "It's 30 shillings for half an hour, or £3.10 for the whole night. I know tricks, dearie." As she moved to permit me to enter, the hall light shone upon my face. She saw my beard and glowered at me. "Oh, it's you," she said frostily, and the smile was wiped from her face as chalk is wiped from a blackboard by a wet rag. She snorted, "Wasting my time. The very idea of it. Here, you," she bawled, "you will have to get a key, I'm usually busy at this time of night." I turned, shut the street door behind me, and made my way down to the dismal basement. There were stacks of cassettes to be developed. It seemed to me that all the photographers in London had dumped their films here. I worked in the Stygian darkness unloading cassettes, fixing clips to one end and inserting them in the tanks. Clack 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 went the timer clock. Quite suddenly the timer bell went off, to tell me that the films were ready for the stop bath. The unexpected sound made me leap to my feet and bump my head against a low beam. Out with all the films, into the stop bath for a few minutes. Out again and into the fixing bath for a quarter of an hour. Another dip, this time in hypo-eliminator, and the films were ready for washing. While this was being done, I switched on the amber light and enlarged up a few proofs. 2 hours later I had the films all developed, fixed, washed, and quick-dried in methylated spirits. For hours on, and I was making rapid progress with the work. I was also becoming hungry. Looking about me, I could see no means of boiling a kettle. There wasn't even a kettle to boil, anyway, so I sat down and opened my sandwiches and carefully washed a photographic measure in order to get a drink of water. I thought of the woman upstairs, wondering if she was drinking beautiful hot tea, and wishing that she would bring me a cup. The door at the head of the basement stairs was flung open with a crash, letting in a flood of light. Hastily I jumped up to cover an opened packet of printing paper before the light spoiled it, as a voice bawled, "Hey! You there? Want a cuppa? Business is bad tonight and I just made myself a pot before turning in. Couldn't get you out of my mind. Must have been telepathy." She laughed at her own joke and clattered down the stairs. Putting down the tray, she sat on the wooden seat, exhaling noisily. "Phew!" she said, "Ain't Alfot down here?" She undid the belt of her dressing gown, pulled it open, and to my horror she had nothing on beneath. She saw my look and cackled, "I'm not trying for you, you've got other developments on your hands tonight." She stood up, her dressing gown falling to the ground, and reached for the stack of drying prints. "Gee!" she exclaimed, leafing through them, "what mugs. Don't know why these geezers have their pictures took." She sat down again, apparently abandoning her dressing gown without regret. It was hot here, and I was getting hotter. "Do you believe in telepathy?" she asked. "Of course I do," I replied. "Well, I saw a show at the Palladium and they did telepathy there." I said it was genuine, but the fellow who took me said it was all a fake. There is an Oriental legend about a traveler on the wide Gobi Desert. His camel had died, and the man was crawling along, almost dying of thirst. Ahead of him he suddenly saw what appeared to be a water skin, a goat skin filled with water which travelers carry. Hurrying desperately to the skin, he bent down to drink, and found it was merely a skin stuffed with first-class diamonds which some other thirsty traveler had thrown away to lighten his load. Such is the way of the West, people seek material riches, seek technical advancement, rockets with bigger and better bangs, pilotless aircraft, and attempted investigation in space. The real values, astral traveling, clairvoyance, and telepathy they treat with suspicion, believing them to be fakes or comic stage turns. When the British were in India, it was well known that the Indians could send messages long distances, telling of revolts, impending arrivals, or any news of interest. Such messages would travel the country in mere hours. The same thing was noticed in Africa and was known as the bush telegraph. With training, there need be no telegraph wires, no telephones to jangle our nerves. People could send messages by their own innate abilities. In the East there have been centuries of study into such matters, Eastern countries are sympathetic to the idea and there is no negative thought to impede the working of the gifts of nature. Marie, I said, I will show you a little trick which demonstrates telepathy, or mind over matter. I being the mind, you being the matter. She looked at me suspiciously, even glowered for a moment, and then replied, all right, anything for a lark. I concentrated my thoughts on the back of her neck, imagining a fly biting her. I visualized the insect biting. Suddenly Marie swatted the back of her neck using a very naughty word to describe the offending insect. I visualized the bite being stronger, and then she looked at me and laughed. My, she said, if I could do that I certainly would have some fun with the fellows who visit me. For night after night I went to the slovenly house in that drab back street. Often, when Marie was not busy, she would come with a teapot of tea to talk and to listen. Gradually I became aware that beneath her hard exterior, in spite of the life which she led, she was a very kind woman to those in need. She told me about the man who employed me and warned me to be at the house early on the last day of the month. Night after night I developed and printed and left everything ready for an early morning collection. For a whole month I saw no one but Marie, then on the 31st, I stayed on late. About 9 o'clock a shifty-looking individual came clattering down the uncarpeted stairs. He stopped at the bottom, and looked at me with open hostility. Think you are going to get paid first, eh? He snarled. You are nightman, get out of here. I will go when I am ready, not before. I answered. You, he said, I'll teach you to give me none of your lip. He snatched up a bottle, knocked off the neck against the wall, and came at me with a roar. Jagged edge aimed straight at my face. I was tired, and quite a little cross. I had been taught fighting by some of the greatest masters of the art in the East. I disarmed the measly little fellow, a simple task, and put him across my knees, giving him the biggest beating he had ever had. Marie, hearing the screams, dashed out from her bed and now sat on the stairs enjoying the scene. The fellow was actually weeping, so I shoved his head in the print washing tank in order to wash away his tears and stop the flow of obscene language. As I let him stand up, I said, stand in that corner. If you move until I say you may, I will start all over again. He did not move. My. That was a sight for sore eyes, said Marie. The little runt is a leader of one of the Soho gangs. You have got him frightened, thought he was the greatest fighter ever, he did. I sat and waited. About an hour later, the man who had employed me came down the stairs, turning pale as he saw me and the gangster. I want my money, I said. It's been a poor month, I haven't any money, I have had to pay protection to him, he said, pointing to the gangster. I looked at him. Do you think I'm working in this stinking hole for nothing? I asked. Give me a few days and I'll see if I can rake some up. He pointing to the gangster, takes all my money because if I don't pay him he gets my men in trouble. No money, not much hope of getting any, either. I agreed to continue for another 2 weeks to give the boss time to get some money somewhere. Sadly I left the house, thinking how fortunate it was that I cycled to Clapham in order to save fares. As I went to unchain my cycle, the gangster sidled furtively up to me. Say, Gov, he whispered hoarsely. Do I want a good job? Look in after me. 20 quid a week, all found. Get out of it, you runny-nosed little squirt. I answered early. 25 quid a week. As I turned towards him in exasperation he skipped nimbly away, muttering, make it 30, top offer, all the women you want, and the booze you can drink, be a sport. At the sight of my expression he vaulted over the basement railing and disappeared into somebody's private rooms. I turned, mounted the bicycle, and rode off. For nearly 3 months I kept the job, doing processing and then having a turn on the streets as street photographer, but neither I nor the other men he got paid. At last, in desperation, we all finished. By now we had moved to one of those dubious squares in the Bayswater district. And I visited labor exchange after labor exchange in an attempt to get work. At last, probably in order to get rid of me, one official said, why don't you go to the higher appointments branch, at Tavistock Square? I'll give you a card. Full of hope I went to Tavistock Square. Wonderful promises were made to me. Here is one of them. By Jove, yes, we can suit you exactly. We want a man for a new atom research station in Caithness, in Scotland. Will you go up for an interview? Industriously he raked among his papers. I replied. Do they pay traveling expenses? Oh. Dear, dear, no, was the emphatic reply. You will have to go at your own expense. On another occasion I travelled, at my own expense, to Cardigan in Wales. A man with a knowledge of civil engineering was required. I travelled, at my own expense, across England and into Wales. The station was a shocking distance from the place of interview. I trudged through the streets of Cardigan and reached the other side. My, my! It is indeed a long way yet, look you, said the pleasant woman of whom I sought directions. I walked on, and at last reached the entrance to a house hidden by trees. The drive was well kept. It was also very long, uphill. At last I reached the house. The amiable man whom I saw looked at my papers, which I had had sent to me in England from Shanghai. He looked, and nodded approvingly. With papers such as these you should have no difficulty in gaining employment, he said. Unfortunately you have no experience in England on civil engineering contracts. Therefore I cannot offer you an appointment. But tell me, he asked, you are a qualified doctor, why did you also study civil engineering? I see you have a bachelor's degree in civil engineering. As a medical man, I was going to travel to remote districts, and I wanted to be able to build my own hospital, I said. HMMPH. He grunted, I wish I could help you, but I cannot. Off I wandered through the streets of Cardigan, back to the dreary railway station. There was a 2-hour wait for a train, but at last I arrived home to report, once again, no job. The next day I went back to the employment agency. The man sitting at his desk, did he ever move? I wondered, said, I say, old boy, we simply cannot talk here. Take me out to lunch and I may be able to tell you something. What? For more than an hour I loitered about in the street outside, looking in the windows, and wishing that my feet would stop aching. A London policeman sourly watched me from the other side of the street, apparently unable to decide if I was a harmless individual or a prospective bank robber. Perhaps his feet were aching too. At last the man was separated from his desk and came clattering down the creaky stairs. A number 79, old boy, we will take a number 79. I know a nice little place, quite moderate for the service they give. We walked up the street, boarded a 79 bus, and soon reached our destination. One of those restaurants in a side street just off a main thoroughfare where the smaller the building the higher the charge. The man without his desk and I had our lunch, mine a very frugal one and his exceedingly ample. Then, with a sigh of satisfaction, he said, you know, old boy, you fellows expect to get good appointments. But do you ever think that if the appointments available were that good, we of the staff would take them first? Our own jobs do not allow us to live in comfort, you know. Well, I said, there must be some way of obtaining employment in this benighted city or outside it. Your trouble is that you look different, you attract attention. You also look ill. Maybe it would help if you shaved off your beard. He gazed at me reflectively, obviously wondering how to make a graceful exit. Suddenly he looked at his watch and jumped to his feet in alarm. I say, old boy, I must simply fly. The old slave master will be watching, you know. He patted my arm and said, Da, don't waste money coming to us, we simply have no jobs except for waiters and their ilk. With that he turned in a whirl and was gone, leaving me to pay his quite considerable bill. I wandered out and along the street. For want of something better to do, I looked at small advertisements in a shop window. Young widow with small child wants work. Man. Able to undertake intricate carvings, needs commissions. Lady Masseurs gives treatment at home. I'll bet she does, I thought. As I walked away, I pondered the question, if the orthodox agencies, bureaus, exchanges etc., could not help me, then why not try an advertisement in a shop window? Why not? Said my poor tired feet as they pounded hollowly on the hard, unsympathetic pavement. That night, at home, I racked my brains trying to work out how to live and how to make enough money to carry on with aura research. At last, I typed 6 postcards saying, Doctor of Medicine, not British registered, offers help in psychological cases. Inquire within. Added another 6 which read, Professional man, very widely traveled, scientific qualifications, offers services for anything unusual. Excellent references. Writebox _ the next day, with the advertisements prominently displayed in certain strategic windows in London shops, I sat back to await results. They came. I managed to obtain enough psychological work to keep me going, and the flickering fires of our finances slowly improved. As a sideline, I did freelance advertising, and one of the greatest pharmaceutical firms in England gave me part-time work. The very generous and human director, a doctor, whom I saw, would have taken me on but for the staff insurance scheme which was in force. I was too old and too sick. The strain of taking over a body was terrible. The strain of having the molecules of the new body exchanged for those of my own was almost more than I could stand, yet, in the interests of science, I stuck it out. More frequently now I travelled in the astral to Tibet by night or on weekends when I knew that I should not be disturbed, for to disturb the body of one who is astral travelling can so easily be fatal. My solace was in the company of those high lamas who could see me in the astral, and my reward was in their commendation of my actions. On one such visit I was mourning the passing of a very much beloved pet, a cat with intelligence to put many humans to shame. An old lama, with me in the astral, smiled in sympathy, and said, My brother, do you not remember the story of the mustard seed? The mustard seed, yes. How well I remembered it, one of the teachings of our faith. The poor young woman had lost her firstborn child. Almost demented with grief, she wandered through the streets of the city, pleading for something, someone, to bring her son back to life. Some people turned away from her in pity, some sneered and mocked her, calling her insane that she should believe her child could be restored to life. She would not be consoled, and none could find words with which to ease her pain. At last an old priest, noting her utter despair, called her and said, There is only one man in the whole world who can help you. He is the perfect one, the Buddha who resides at the top of that mountain. Go and see him. The young bereaved mother, her body aching with the weight of her sorrow, slowly walked up the hard mountain path until at last she turned a corner and saw the Buddha seated upon a rock. Prostrating herself, she cried, Oh! Buddha! Bring my son back to life. The Buddha rose and gently touched the poor woman, saying, Go down into the city. Go from house to house and bring to me a mustard seed from a house in which no one has ever died. The young woman shouted with exultation as she rose to her feet and hastened down the mountainside. She hurried to the first house and said, The Buddha bids me bring a mustard seed from a house which has never known death. In this house, she was told, many have died. At the next house she was told, It is impossible to tell how many have died here, for this is an old house. She went from house to house, throughout that street, to the next street, and the one after. Scarcely pausing for rest or food, she went through the city from house to house, and she could not find a single house which had not at some time been visited by death. Slowly she retraced her steps up the mountain slopes. The Buddha was, as before, sitting in meditation. Have you brought the mustard seed? He asked. No, nor do I seek it any more, she said. My grief blinded me so that I thought that only I suffered and sorrowed. Then why have you again come to me? Asked the Buddha. To ask you to teach me the truth, she answered. And the Buddha told her, In all the world of man, and all the world of gods, this alone is the law, all things are impermanent. Yes, I knew all the teachings, but the loss of one dearly loved was still a loss. The old lama smiled again and said, A beautiful little person shall come to you to cheer your extraordinary difficult and hard life. Wait. Sometime after, several months after, we took the Lady Kuei into our home. She was a Siamese kitten of surpassing beauty and intelligence. Brought up by us as one would bring up a human, she has responded as a good human would. Certainly she has lightened our sorrows and eased the burden of human treachery. Freelance work without any legal standing was difficult indeed. Patients subscribed to the view that the devil was ill, the devil a monk would be. The devil was well, the devil was he. The stories which defaulting patients told to explain their non-payment would fill many books, and cause the critics to work overtime. I continued my search for permanent work. "Oh," said a friend, "you can do freelance writing, ghostwriting. Have you thought of that? A friend of mine has written a number of books. I will give you an introduction to him." Off I went to one of the great London museums to see the friend. Into an office I was shown, and for a moment I thought I was in the museum storeroom. I was afraid to move in case I knocked something over, so I just sat and became weary of sitting. At last the friend came in. "Books?" he said. "Freelance writing? I'll put you in touch with my agent. He may be able to fix you up." He scribbled industriously, and then handed me a paper with an address upon it. Almost before I knew what had happened, I was outside the office. "Well," I thought, "will this be another wild goose chase?" I looked at the piece of paper in my hand. "Regent Street?" Now, which end of the street would it be? I got out of the train at Oxford Circus, and with my usual luck, found that I was at the wrong end. Regent Street was crowded, people seemed to be milling round the entrance of the big stores. A boys' brigade or Salvation Army band, I did not know which, was proceeding noisily down Conduit Street. I walked on, past the Goldsmiths and Silversmiths Company, thinking how a little of their wares would enable me to get on with research. Where the street curved to enter Piccadilly Circus, I crossed the road and looked for that wretched number. Travel agency, shoe shop, but no author's agent. Then I saw the number, sandwiched in between two shops. In I went to a little vestibule at the far end of which was an open lift. There was a bell push, so I used it. Nothing happened. I waited perhaps 5 minutes and then pressed the button again. A clatter of feet. "You brought me up from the col au lait," said a voice. "I was just having a cup of tea. Which floor do I want?" "Mr. B underscore," I said, "I do not know which floor." "Or, third floor," said the man. "Ease in." I took him up. "This is it," he said, sliding open the iron gate. "Turn right, in that door." With that he disappeared back to his cooling tea. I pushed open the door indicated and walked up to a little counter. "Mr. B underscore?" I said. "I have an appointment with him." The dark-haired girl went off in search of Mr. B underscore and I looked around me. At the other side of the counter girls were drinking tea. An elderly man was being given instruction about delivering some parcels. There was a table behind me with a few magazines upon it, like in a dentist's waiting room, I thought, and on the wall was an advertisement for some publishers. The office space seemed to be littered with parcels of books, and newly opened typescripts were in a neat row against a far wall. "Mr. B underscore will be with you in a moment," said a voice, and I turned to smile my thanks to the dark-haired girl. At that moment a side door opened, and Mr. B underscore came in. I looked at him with interest for he was the first author's agent I had ever seen, or heard of. He had a beard, and I could visualize him as an old Chinese mandarin. Although an Englishman, he had the dignity and courtesy of an elderly, educated Chinese of which there is no peer in the West. Mr. B underscore came, greeted me and shook my hand, and let me through the side door to a very small room which reminded me of a prison cell without the bars. "And now what can I do for you?" he asked. "I want a job," I said. He asked me questions about myself, but I could see from his aura that he had no job to offer, that he was being courteous because of the man who had introduced me. I showed him my Chinese papers, and his aura flickered with interest. He picked them up, examined them most carefully, and said, "You should write a book. I think I can get one commissioned for you." This was a shock which almost bowled me over. Me write a book? Me? About me? I looked at his aura carefully in order to see if he really meant it or if it was just a polite brush off. His aura said that it was meant but that he had a doubt as to my writing ability. As I took my leave his last words were, "You really should write a book." Or, "Don't look so glum," said the liftman. "The sun is shining outside. Didn't you want your book?" That's just the trouble, I replied, as I got out of the lift. He did. I walked along Regent Street thinking that everyone was mad. Me write a book. Crazy.